I saw you released a note over the weekend on the shooting in Pittsburgh. In your role with police, this synagogue was obviously a sensitive target for potential hate crimes. How much communication and planning usually goes on between a police force and a house of worship?
Usually there's a lot of outreach, certainly in my career. I mean, I didn't just run departments. I ran precincts and districts as I went up the ranks, and we all had that geographical accountability, and the houses of worship that were within those precincts and districts. In particular, in Brooklyn, East Flatbush, Brooklyn, Ocean Parkway, when I was the commander of the 70th Precinct, very sensitive Hasidic Jewish community, and we also had the largest Arabic population in the city of New York, so it was quite a hodgepodge, and there was ongoing communication on both sides all the time. We had a house of worship plan that we could basically take off the shelf and implement in a moment's notice, with special attention and officers deployed, depending on what was going on. So that is something that we pay an awful lot of attention to. It crosses all boundaries, you know, Muslim, Jewish, whatever.
The president brings up that if there was a security guard outside of the synagogue, the shooting may not have been as deadly. Now, this obviously, once again, opens the gun debate. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I've been involved in this gun debate for a very, very, very long time. And the way that I like to characterize it is, you know, when we were using quote-unquote deterrent in the Cold War, it was our nuclear missiles are bigger than Russia's. And that doesn't really work. So I don't think having an armed populace is the way to go here. But we need a reasonability in the gun laws. For instance, I haven't heard too much debate about the fact that this guy had an AR-15. I still don't understand what the Second Amendment has to do with assault weapons, because assault weapons are created for military purposes to kill people in combat. That's what they're made for, just like hand grenades and howitzers. So if the right to bear arms, where does it stop? Why can't we buy hand grenades? I mean, this is not okay what's happening here. And what's lost on people is the fact that the Second Amendment was written in regards to a single-shot, smooth-bore, flintlock rifle, not the weaponry that we're seeing today. So I don't understand why we sell assault weapons in a civilized society. It just doesn't make sense.
Over the weekend in Chicago, more than 40 people were shot, 5 people were killed. What is the biggest thing hamstringing the city right now when it comes to gun violence?
Well, we got to stop letting people out of jail. You know, one of the issues that we have is at the county level, certainly Tony Preckwinkle brags about the fact that you cut the prison population in half, which under normal circumstances might be a good thing. But what's happening when those people are out instead of in prison? What are they doing? They're probably committing more crime. So we don't have a functional criminal justice system here in the city of Chicago or in the county of Cook. And that needs to be addressed. And that's something that we were talking about over and over and over again. There's a lot of confusion. People don't understand the issue of mass incarceration, which really is the result of a failed war on narcotics. Some people do have to go to jail, and it's the individuals who are most likely to commit a crime and kill somebody are the ones that have to go to jail. And that's not what's happening here. We see it over and over again. The worst example was Paul Bauer. We had a high-ranking police official murdered by a 4-time convicted felon wearing body armor with an extended magazine in his gun in the shadow of City Hall on state property. So, you know, if you want to talk about having an urban blight problem, this is contributing to it in a very significant fashion.
Where do you stand on the proposed consent decree between the city of Chicago and Attorney General's office?
So, my read on it, number of things, really four or five things. First of all, who was the police policy expert who contributed to that consent decree? Because I don't know who it was. As a matter of fact, I don't think there was a police policy expert. I think it was put together by elected officials and civilians. So we can't legislate good policing. As a matter of fact, if we look at some of the failures of the Chicago Police Department, for instance, the whole issue of the investigative stop report is the result of legislation in Springfield called Senate Bill 1304, which requires officers to record all that information that is akin to doing a robbery investigation rather than just an index card that records why, when, and who you stopped. So the consent decree is very heavy on documenting behavior. It's not really changing policy. As a matter of fact, most of the policies that are in there are already in effect. What it's heavy on is supervisors documenting those behaviors, not supervising. That is a recipe for disaster. Additionally, I'm curious if this is going to be the standard for every police department in the state of Illinois, considering that this is in agreement with the state attorney general. And then lastly, there's a cottage industry that's been created in this country for police monitors. And it costs millions and millions and millions of dollars. You all know what type of condition we are in financially here in the city of Chicago to get out of those consent decrees. And it's really difficult to get out of them because I want you to picture this. I'm getting paid to monitor the police department, and I also make a decision as to when they're in compliance with everything that they need to do to get out of it. So essentially, they keep the consent decrees going longer than they need to, and it costs millions of dollars because the individual making the decision is the individual who's getting paid. So there's so many problems with this. I just don't see it as helping us. I think what we're going to see is more time being spent on administrative duties than doing police work. And as we all know, we have a violence problem in this city. So blaming the police for all of that is not going to help.
And with so many people now in the race for mayor, does it make it harder or easier to campaign?
Well, I got to tell you, the more people that come in, the less it really affects us. There's only going to be probably four or five significant contenders when the dust settles here. And honestly, anybody who jumped into this race after the mayor declared that he wasn't running is not doing it for the best interests of the people of Chicago. They're doing it for themselves. They're doing it for some selfish reason. And these are all politicians. So if everywhere I go, people want and they talk about change in Chicago. And if you go with the same old, you're not going to get change. And we certainly need change here. So those people who came in after the mayor dropped out are not doing it to change things. They're all part of the status quo and how we got in this condition in the first place. So it's not really making it harder to campaign. I'm very confident. Polling is very strong. We're raising money. So it's going extremely well, and I'm actually having fun doing it because I enjoy talking to people.